serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our eye-opening conversation with 95-year-old Ray Lloyd of Grover Beach, California. He's helped us understand what it was like aboard the cruiser USS Portland, which, among other close calls, was hit by three Japanese torpedoes in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands in October 1942. Ray is here in part because none of those torpedoes detonated and because he made his way through several other life-threatening scenarios on the Portland and the aircraft carrier USS Kitkin Bay.
We was under a heavier air attack, and they came in on our starboard side, and they came between the gap between the two carriers, and we were six of us there, two abreast, and they came through there, and we were firing in there, of course. All of a sudden, the gun starts swinging. At the same time it started swinging away from there, I was wondering, you know, I was going, what happened then? And about the same time, the gun captain climbed clear over the hip. The gun was pounding on my helmet. And I looked up to see what was going on, and he's pointing dead astern. And I look, and here's one of those Bettys. It was right on top of us. The bomb bay doors was open. And I jumped up on the, got him in the ring sight, and I dropped down on the scope. And I can see the pilot's face and the co-pilot's face just as clear as I can see yours. That's how close they were. And I pulled the trigger, and it was just boom, boom. And there was nothing. We evidently set the torpedo off. And of course, that's almost 2,000 pounds. And it just absolutely vaporized that plane. Wow. It was just gone. And of course, all the guys in the started cheering and hollering, you know. Then we got right back over where the rest of them was coming in on us. But that was kind of strange because I'd been shooting at planes and ships. But that's the first time I ever looked two people in the eye, you know. And I knew there was about seven guys on that bomber crew. I kept visualizing those two guys' faces for two or three days. And I was wondering, I wonder if they were married, if they had kids, stuff like that, you know. Wonder if their parents aren't ever going to see it. It kind of bugged me, even if they were the enemy. It bugged me. But anyway, I got over that and just kept on shooting.
Well, and there's another side to that, as I'm thinking, and you correct me if I'm wrong. But the timing of that seems pretty incredible. If he didn't tap you, if you didn't act as quickly as you did, and boom, boom, as you said, I mean, if you're a second later, that Betty is dropping that bomb, that torpedo, on your ship, and a whole bunch of Americans, a whole bunch of your fellow sailors are going to lose their lives, maybe even you.
Yeah, that all probably took place in, I'd say, less than 15 seconds, because the loaders, they were aware of it. The loaders were behind me, and they were facing the gun captain. And I don't know where the word came from, whether it was from a lookout, because the lookouts were given a sector to watch. And no matter what's going on around them, that was their section. So somebody spotted that plane. And by the time word got to us, it was on top, I guess. But by the time I got up to the ring sight and dropped down to the scope, I already knew the gun was loaded because I'd been tapped. More of a hit than a tap. But anyway, I pulled the trigger just as soon as I matched up with the trainer, as soon as I got the crosshairs matched, because he was ahead of me. He had a head start, so I matched up with him and pulled the trigger. Well, you couldn't miss him. It was just flying right down the gun barrel to begin with. Probably, I'd say he was that close to the water. He was probably 15 feet above the water, and that's about where we would have been, 15, 20 feet. So he was right straight at us. Couldn't miss him. Not an automatic weapon fired. It was just our gun. And right after it blew up, they called down the, you know, the fire control people up on the bridge. Called down and said, paint a flag on that barrel. So we had one painted on there.
Well, and I guess that's the question that I wonder. And maybe you can answer, maybe you can't. What would have happened if your gun didn't shoot that plane down?
Well, they would have dropped the torpedo. And I've thought of that too, because he was coming up our wake. I don't know where, of course, we were going full bore. And of course, when I say full bore, we're talking about 18, 19 knots. Anyway, I don't know whether wake would have deflected it or not, or whether he'd been too close. But all I know is he was right there. 1 second he was there, and the next they were gone. And all this took place, you know, just boom, boom, just like that. But anyway, he didn't get us. We got him first. I look at it that way.
If he had been able to launch that torpedo, and it did
explode in your ship? You think you'd be here?
Nope. It would have took the whole stern off.
Well, I'm sure there's some more stories, Ray, and I don't want to leave anything out, but it just something's occurring to me as I sit here and listen to some of what you've shared and try to imagine myself, as I'm sure a lot of people listening are at home right now, in your shoes as a teenager in World War II. I know that you're someone who faith plays a big role in your life because it's one of your friends from church who ratted you out and told me to come interview you. Do you look back on some of those close calls and those instances where so many others lost their lives or you easily could have? And do you think that God was intervening on your behalf? How do you explain that?
Well, I'm a believer in the good God up above, because not only during the war did I have close calls, it's just like we was under attack by a suicide plane. This was on the carrier, and we were invading Luzon. We went under a big air attack, suicide planes. This plane was diving down on us, and I was looking up because our gun was pointing up because they was all diving on us. I see this plane out of the corner of my eye. It's got me. It's coming right straight towards me. And I just kind of cringed over against the gun because I knew this was it. And the Quad 40 up on the corner, the flight deck, got off one clip, and it took the left wing off of that plane, which at, you know, the high speed they're diving caused the plane immediately to turn to the right where the wing was on, and it went into the water, just barely missed us. That had my name on it, and the good Lord upstairs decided that 40 better take the wing off of that plane. I've had a lot of close calls. I'm in a railroad, and an inspector, you go around, you got an inspection hammer, you check all the nuts and bolts, make sure cotter keys and all that stuff in. I was underneath it checking the washout plugs in the boiler, go along, tap the plugs, make sure everything's going. I went down there, tapped the things, and went to the front of the engine, turned around, come back, and you had to get back by the oil tender and the water tender to get out from under the locomotive. And I just got back there, put my chest up over the bank to get out of the pit, and boom, that washout plug on that boiler blew out, and that pit was full of scalding hot water and steam instantly. And my legs was just like they was on fire, but I managed to roll out of the way. I got up, and then I was having trouble breathing because of so much steam in the air. And then I started feeling my way back, feeling the oil tender to get away from it. And then I had to be careful because that's where the turntable was, and I didn't want to fall in the pit. So anyway, I kept feeling my way till I got to the end of the tender, and I quit walking because I knew the pit was next. So I stayed there and it cleared up enough. And, of course, here come running everybody, the bosses. Was anybody in there? Was anybody in there? And I told them, no, I was the only guy in, and I just barely got out. That was another close shave. That one really got my attention. That would be a horrible way to go, wouldn't it?
Ooh, yeah, and that would be pretty devastating for your wife and kids, and now you've got grandkids and great-grandkids. Yeah. And none of that ever would have happened if you didn't make it through the war. And we've heard how close you came a few times. But speaking of your wife of 72 years, Elma, I've got to hear the story of how you two met.
Well, I was fancy free in those days. I just got out of the Navy, and I was running around having a good time. One of the fellows I worked with on the railroad, he had a friend. She was a friend of Elma's. So anyway, we somehow or other ended up over the friend's house, and that's when I first saw Elma. I got to thinking, oh, I'll ask her for a date. So that's what I did, and we started in dating, and this went from bad to worse. Now I'm married. So it's lasted for 72 years, so it wasn't a bad decision.
I guess not. And you mentioned working for the railroad after the service. You worked at Vandenberg Air Force Base and then Port Hueneme, a Navy base. And you had an experience recently where you got to go back to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Central Coast, California, with other veterans to see the World War II Memorial and other sites. What did that do for you? What was that experience like?
Well, my brother always told me there's no such thing as a free lunch, and he was a veteran, and it's too bad he didn't live to see it, because he would say there was a free lunch. I'm telling you, I was never treated so well in my life, and I had a fella, I'm up and around, and I'm walking, and he had to push a wheelchair everywhere I went in case I wanted to sit down. And anyhow, he did. They fed us like kings. They stayed in the best hotel. They took us to anything that amounted to anything as far as war monuments were concerned. And I was absolutely impressed with the whole thing. We got to see everything. My wife says when we got home and they picked me up out of the airport, I couldn't quit talking about what happened. So. Anyhow, I wasn't aware of that, but it was a thrilling trip. It was unbelievable, let's put it that way, to think that people had, you know, put up that money. It was unbelievable, but it happened, and it's still happening.
Well, it is, and the reason people do it is because they know what you did for us so many years ago. And I do have to ask you specifically about your time at the National World War II Memorial, because that's a lot to take in. You've got the Atlantic side and the Pacific side and the pillars for every state and different plaques about different parts of the war, some of which were areas where you were. And then there's that wall of the gold stars representing 406,000 Americans who didn't get to come home from the war. What was going through your mind while you were looking at all of that?
Well, when I saw all those stars and how many Americans had been killed, I absolutely couldn't believe it. It's unbelievable that many men was killed. And that's just our country. You know, thousands, millions were killed elsewhere. That got to me to think that many people had been killed. But there's nothing easy about war. So I, of course, looked around. There's a lot to see there. And so I went all around to the different places, and I took a lot of pictures and stuff. But it was amazing to think that that many guys got killed. And when the war was over, I went back to the high school there one day, and I absolutely was dumbfounded how many guys I went to school with were killed in that war. East Bakersfield lost a lot of guys that graduating class. So the class I was in, I don't know about the rest of them, but it was a horrible thing, that amount of people getting killed. But that's what happened.
Well, I guess there's an important question I need to ask you about those guys who were killed, but I don't want to forget to first say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that nobody else could tell us. When you think about those guys, your classmates at East Bakersfield High, the Marines aboard your ship to Portland that you told us about, others who lost their lives, how should we remember and honor those guys today? What should we think about when we consider them?
Well, speaking of friends and stuff, there's one friend, his name was Ray Vercammon. His dad was a barber in East Bakersfield. Between the Portland and the Kitkin Bay, I was home on leave, and there was a football game at East High. So I go to the football game, and there he is. He's in the Army Air Force. And so we're sitting together talking, because we hadn't seen each other. He was telling me that he was a waist gunner on a B-17. And he says to me, "We fly in this box formation," and he says, "the fighters can't get at you. It's really a good job. He's a waist gunner." And I'm saying to myself, boy, that's not the way it works. I started to tell him, and then I figured it was none of my business. But I was going to tell him, look, you get out of that job as quick as you can, because we swat airplanes down like flies. I didn't, and I've always felt guilty about that, but he probably wouldn't have listened to me anyhow. So that's one thing I recall from guys I went to school with.
So he was shot down?
Yeah, he was killed, and his brother. This family had two sons. They were lost both of them. My brother was in the first wave to hit the beach at Iwo. He was a coxswain on a landing barge. He said he dropped the gate, and he doesn't think one Marine got out of that boat. They just was right in the, you know, they had the beach all zeroed in and just machine gunned right through that boat. Of course, he had armor around him, you know, and he made three trips to the beach, and he had to be sedated and put in the sick bay. He was just completely out of it. Anyhow, but there is one thing I'd like to tell you about. That's the battle for Leyte Gulf. When they decided to invade Leyte the first time, MacArthur wanted to go to the Philippines, they assigned 18 of us small aircraft carriers to give cover for the Army. The Army was going to land on the beach. First time we'd ever been with the Army. Anyway, we took off 18 carriers in a row, two wide, our six-group deal, three groups. We're in the middle of this convoy, and I don't care which way you look, you couldn't run out of ships. As far as your eye could reach was ships. They're going to invade Leyte. So we're always briefed. Once we're underway and we can't give up any secrets, then the captain briefs you, you know, that we were going to capture Leyte Island. That was our job. So when we get there, they break up the carriers. Six carriers through group, three groups. Taffy 1 was south. Taffy 2 was in the middle. Taffy 3 was the furthest north. So we're up there. We're, of course, at our battle stations, at general quarters. The sun's going down. Troops are going to hit the beach the next morning. Here comes Halsey with his fleet. It's mind-boggling. They had 12 fast carriers, battleships, battle cruisers, heavy cruisers, light cruisers, destroyers. I don't know, there's 60 or 70 ships in the group, all in this formation. They're right around us. And we're all telling each man, we finally got some help, because they'd always leave us by ourselves before. The sun goes down, we secure from battle station. Next morning, we go to general quarters for the sun to come up. Sun comes up, and way out on the horizon is this big fleet. We see it out there, everybody sees it. We secure from general quarters. I go down in the mess hall. I'm not down there 10 minutes or so. The guy comes running through, and he says, Lloyd, you better get on your gun. The whole Jap fleet's out there. And I said, oh, yeah. And I looked at his face, and I knew he was serious. And I took off, and just as I got out there to the gun, here comes a salvo from the battle, the world's largest battleship, two of them, 18-inch guns. And they were shelling us. So, of course, we jumped on the gun, started shooting back, and I guess I maybe got off 10 shots or something, and this loader's pounding on my shoulder. I'm thinking, this is going to get old. So I jumped up and I hollered over to gun captain that I was going to go electric. So I threw the gun over on electric so whenever the breech would close, it would fire. And the gun captain would know when to tell him to cease fire, when, you know, whatever he wanted to do. So that took that off of me and the loader. And so we just kept shooting. That went on and on and on. So anyhow, we survived that. We lost the two carriers because when the Japanese fleet left, we had planes from all the other carriers finally come to help us. This battle went on for 2 hours and 15 minutes. We were laying smoke and everything else. They finally broke it off. After they broke it off, we figured, well, that's that. And that's when we had the honor of having the first suicide plane attacks. They came in on us, and we didn't realize that at first. But it didn't take long to wise up. And they sank the St. Lo. She blew all the pieces that set off her torpedo bay. They said we lost two destroyers, one destroyer escort, and two carriers. That day was finally over. Everybody's wondering, where's Halsey? Where's the fleet? Well, Halsey, he had all the brains. He had left a message that he was putting a task group something so-and-so off to help around there. Well, he never did, because he's so headstrong that he knew everything. Well, anyway, he's gone with the whole fleet. They could have taken care of that whole Japanese fleet in a half hour if they'd have been there, but they weren't, so we fought the battleships with 5-inch guns. Anyway, Halsey took off. He was responsible for leaving. He's responsible, as far as I'm concerned, for over 1,000 men losing their lives that day.
Well, I'm glad you weren't one of them, and I'm glad we got to hear your story today. I guess the one more question I have to ask you, at 95 years old, what are you most proud of? What are you most thankful for?
Well, I figure I'm proud of the fact that myself and about 16 million other guys was in the service defending this country, sticking up for the rights of individuals, for free speech and all that stuff. But it looks like to me nowadays with the politicians is going down the drain. Sometimes I think it was a waste of time. But anyway, I'm proud of that, and I'm also proud of the fact that my wife and I have managed to stay married for 72 years, and we've had kids, and we've lost a couple, and that's hard, but that's just part of life, and we'll see them again when we're in heaven, so that's it. I figure I did my part, and since I've been back, my wife and I have done a lot of charity work. I drove for the senior citizen, taking people, older people, to the senior center for dinners and stuff like that for a long time, and then I worked in the church people's kitchen for a good 15 years, my wife and I, but we finally reached a point where we had to give it up because of old age, so I'm just sitting around now just waiting for the big day.
Well, here's hoping there are a lot of memorable days before that one big day arrives. Thanks to Michael and Peggy Smith for letting me know about their friends from church, Ray and Elma Lloyd, who will celebrate that 72nd anniversary on New Year's Eve. And thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.